It feels to me on this Easter Sunday afternoon like such a gentle time. And I have to say this makes me particularly happy because I think gentleness is one of the most beautiful and most deeply needed aspects of kindness, that a gentle moment can be so healing and so strengthening, that gentleness and strength grow back to back. And isn't that a lovely thing to discover? That the more gentle we can afford to be, the stronger also we can afford to be. So the first of these questions is, in today's world where traditional churches seem less relevant to people, how do we ensure children are introduced to a community of spiritual awareness? Well, I think one of the marvelous things about today's world is that community has so many layers of meaning, and that we can have a sense of community that's extremely intimate, that is about two or three people, and at the very same time, we can have a sense of belonging to a community that is so vast that even in our imagination, we can scarcely encompass it. And I think children take this kind of realization on in a very, very natural way. So, for example, I can well imagine with many children that we can introduce the ideas around spirituality, which really means around the ways in which we connect with life and we create meaning out of life and we express our gratitude and joy in life. I think that's what spirituality is. It's not really a set of dogma or vestments or practices even. It's much more about attitude and how attitude shapes those small and large moments that we live alongside one another. So, for example, a child who grows up truly appreciated for who they are and not just for their achievements, already experiences something that is profoundly important in the spiritual realm. The child who grows up where there is a culture of gratitude. Gratitude for the food that they're going to eat. Gratitude for the small acts of kindness. Gratitude for the gifts that each of us have and not squandering that gratitude with worrying about the gifts that we don't have, the things that we're not so good at. Gratitude for the joy and beauty that is in daily life. All of that creates a personality self as well as a soul that's highly receptive also to the small, quite casual and natural teachings that come through the way you talk about incidents, through the way you talk about other people, through the way that you talk about difficulties and how you've overcome them, and through that, the learning that life is complex, that there is suffering in life, but that not all of the suffering is necessary, and that it makes a profound difference when we meet suffering with insight, forgiveness, and kindness. And when we don't add to it through our rage or outrage that such things have happened to us. When we don't behave as though suffering is something that should only happen to other people. Yeah. When we learn self-mastery, self-discipline, even some self-control, so that we can take into account other people's needs, and we realize that we are a unique individual, a unique soul, but that we live alongside 6 or 7 billion other unique souls. And when we also discover that sometimes we shift our anxieties, our fears, our self-absorption most effectively by engaging with others. So that gradually others become real to us. So that they're not just people who are more or less useful to us, but that they're actually people living alongside us in smaller and greater communities, which is where we began this question, community. Yeah. The last thing I want to say about that is that children, chronological children, and also the child in us, is highly receptive to beauty, to teachings that are uplifting, to ideas that are uplifting, to stories and poetry and adventures that are uplifting, that tell them how large life can be, not how small they are. Someone asks me here to name the obstacles to kindness. I named perfectionism, actually, not perfectionism. That is being obsessed with some notion of perfection, not perfection itself. This moment is perfect. But often what we are grasping at is some notion of perfectionism that is actually meant to reassure us, not that that moment is perfect, but that we're okay. When we worry about everything being all right, we're really worrying about, am I all right? Am I all right? Am I all right? Take it for granted. It's all right. Even when it's not all right, it's all right. Somewhere. It's all right. Can you briefly name the others? Ah, yes, I can. Some of the obstacles to kindness. Self-righteousness is a very big obstacle to kindness. Hostility, prejudice, the delusion that life owes me and I can't afford to be kind. The delusion that there isn't enough kindness to go around, and if I give you some of mine, I won't have enough left for myself. Also, a misunderstanding of what kindness is, mistaking it for weakness. If I'm kind, does it mean that you will walk all over me? Does it mean that you will take me for granted? Does it mean that you can manipulate me? We live in a very competitive, adversarial world. We don't live in a world in which kindness and all its expressions, where was that beautiful little expressions of kindness that I had? One of you will bring it to me in a moment. And All right. If I remind you of how diversely kindness can be expressed, you will also be reminded of some of the ways in which it can be squashed. But what we are gathering here is our energy to express it. Patience. Such a kindness, isn't it? That when we finally get to the front of the queue, we don't actually have to complain for 5 minutes so that the people standing behind us in the queue have to stand there even longer because we are complaining so forcefully about having had to stand in the queue. And when I spoke at the beginning of this retreat about what I'm learning again so delightfully in the company of my granddaughter and other babies that are in my life and little ones, that really they like people on the basis of how kind they are, not how grand they are. And here I have this wonderful teaching from Rabbi Heschel, who's such a hero. When I was young, I admired clever people. Now that I'm old, I admire kind people. And actually, when we're young, we admire kind people, but we also admire playful people, and we admire patient people. Because when we're young, we're learning all the time. And sometimes when we get older, we refuse to be learning all the time, although we need to be learning all the time because we haven't been in this moment before. Have we? Maybe in our past life, but not in this one. So we need to be patient with ourselves in order that we can be patient with other people. And some of us are monstrously impatient with ourselves. Respect. Some of us are very disrespectful to ourselves, put ourselves down, speak about ourselves in ways that are abhorrent. We need to get over it. I'm not going to read all of these out, but oh, such beautiful expressions of kindness here. Thoughtfulness. And isn't it often just the smallest act of thoughtfulness? And let inspiration guide you here. If inspiration says to you, do ring that friend. Okay, you haven't rung them for 2 years, but ring them now. If inspiration says, pick up that book. If inspiration says, go to your cushion, even though the pathway is very dusty. Go, pick up the phone. Ask, receive, do, make, engage. Engage. Appreciation, gratitude, gentleness, enthusiasm, grace. Grace is the unasked for. Something that arises and reconnects you not just to this moment, but to all the potency that is in this moment that arises from the temple that is your heart. What suggestions do you have for sustaining the learnings from here back into our daily lives? It's your choice. It's your choosing. It's your engagement. It's your willingness to embody. It's your willingness to be active, not just to receive, but to give. Hilary and I have separately and together offered you some opportunities for support. I offer you other opportunities to engage on Facebook, to engage through the Universal Heart Network, to come to services, to engage with other sources of spiritual nourishment. We do need to engage, but the choice is yours. You know, when we were having our beautiful healing service last night, and Stephen offered us a number of invitations. Now, it's like a letter. Someone offers you an invitation that is inside an envelope, but you have to open the envelope. You have to take out the invitation. You have to read it and find it meaningful. And then you have to engage. And also, it's so lovely to remember, isn't it, that your spiritual practice and your daily life are one and the same. Your spiritual practice is not something that just supports your daily life. There will be aspects of your daily life that you might call spiritual practice, but actually your spiritual practice is your life, and your life is your spiritual practice. The difficult moments are such good practice. So think about the invitation of a particular moment and how you will engage with it. What you will make of it. How you will respond to it. It's like a covenant. It's like a communion with you and the opportunity of the present moment. And some of that opportunity also is about surrendering doing sometimes in order that we have more energy to do what is sustaining. Thank you for these questions. Uncertainty is positive. That's a quote from me saying, we don't want to have a closed mind. We don't want to be so certain that it tips into the shadow, which is self-righteousness or a fundamentalist kind of view. And please don't think that the fundamentalist view lives only in those that we call fundamentalists, because the fundamentalist is an archetype that's alive and well in everyone. Isn't it? Yeah. Thank you, Stephen. So this person says, I don't want my uncertainty to become indecision. And I understand that. And if one is chronically indecisive, that does need some attention. Really asking yourself, why is it so difficult to make a choice? Because often what you're making a choice between is really pretty unimportant. So it doesn't really matter what you choose. So save your energy for the choices that matter. And if you're still having difficulties, write about it in your journal. I'm having difficulty choosing. Is it because I'm so attached to what I eventually land on? Or is it because I chronically think, oh, if only. So some of it's just habits of mind. Needs recycling. However, sometimes it actually is an expression of anxiety. And we need to go a little bit deeper. And from a place of kindness, And from a place of compassion, we really need to ask ourselves, what is it that I'm anxious about here? What is it that I'm fearing? What is it that I feel I don't have enough of? Where am I not quite strong enough to face this? So I immediately also think about those examples that I gave you of these ridiculous things. You know, I need to change my car, I need to change my phone for really good reasons. And I'm sort of dreading the process of change. So I hover in my indecisiveness, because I don't actually want to commit the time to the change. But sometimes it's about something that's much more fundamental than a phone or a car. And there we really need to look at it. And the journal, the writing down the question, the asking in the journal, what is needed here? Some of you may have done this kind of thing from my creative journal writing book. It's also, I give instructions quite clearly in Choosing Happiness, but I give more instruction in the creative journal writing book, and I really do recommend it very much as part of our, not just spiritual practice, as part of our growing up into our wiser self. Yeah. So we're less haunted by some of these inhibitions, because that's what anxiety does. Anxiety inhibits us. It mars and distorts our freedom. And what we're seeking as we grow spiritually more resilient is greater freedom. So we want to be freed from our indecisiveness when it's chronic. But we don't need to be freed into a place of absolute certainty. We can be freed into a relationship with certainty that also allows for continuing to know more, to discover more, to reflect more, to allow life to teach us more. Do you see the difference between certainty? This is how things are. I have the answers. My answers are right. And if my answer is right, it is wholly right. Wholly. And therefore, your answers, if they are a jot different, must be wholly wrong. Wholly. Whew! That pattern of thinking, of course, is very reassuring, but it's also very restrictive. And it keeps us from growing into ourselves. How do you get your inner critic to retire itself when it puts up a fierce battle several years long against being retired? There's not a day that passes when I do not hear its tyrannical voice, and I desperately want to retire it. Okay, be less desperate. Be far less desperate. Do you see that meeting the inner critic with desperation means that a similar energy meets it? When desperate meets desperate, we get more desperate. In the same way, when our children or a partner or someone at work is highly agitated, and we meet it with our agitation, which is often our first impulse, we get an increase in agitation. And I must say to you, it takes a great deal of will and many false turns and a lot of practice to meet agitation with something other than agitation. We might really need to take several breaths to meet it from a different place, which might mean saying, I really need to think about this. And just refusing to engage in that moment, but in a respectful way. I really need to think about this. I haven't thought about it that way. I really need to think about this. Not engaging with the content at all. Yeah? Do you see that? Even if it's your child, I really need to think about this. And I had such a nice example before I came away from somebody close to me who's also a grandmother, and she told me that her daughter-in-law has what she calls a thinking chair for her little girls. So when they explode beyond the limits of tolerance, they're not sent to what so many children these days seem to be sent to, the naughty chair, which is rather odious, isn't it? They're sent to the thinking chair. I'm very happy to have a chat with Deb about this, because Deb actually works with children who in schools who need to live their life on the thinking chair. But I thought, you know, we all need to retire to the thinking chair, really. And in a way, the not thinking chair of our meditation also supports us in this. The no thinking chair supports us in this. That actually there is time and space, but we have to claim it. So again, we're really talking about claiming it. And let me say to you, in the most companionable way that I can, that you might forget this 100 times and rejoice if you remember it the 101st. Okay, so back to this. So this person is in a fierce battle against their inner critic. Rather than, for example, popping the inner critic in the chair next to me, giving them a hug and saying, you've done just such good service. You have so much energy. I need your energy to support me. What other face? What other strength, what other insight can your energy bring me? The critic wants to save us from making a complete fool of ourselves. But the critic has misunderstood what makes us a complete fool, hasn't it? And this is a conversation, again, that you can have in your journal, where you're really dialoguing, let me say to you, with your wise being, your inner teacher, the only teacher that really counts. And how do you know if it's the inner teacher or if it's the ego? And what a shame John isn't here. So John, if you're listening later, I'm thinking about you. How do we know when it's the inner critic or the wise being? We know because we are flooded with love. Because we could almost weep Even when I'm telling you this, I know it. We know it because it's the teaching of love that we hear. The wise teacher would never put us down. They might say, really, you could afford to pay much more attention to this and far less attention to that. They might even say, are you willing to grow up? Yep, they might say that. But they would say it with love. Because growing up is also a choice, isn't it? And it doesn't mean that we have to leave behind the delights of childhood. But it does mean that we have more choices. Remember that as glorious as childhood is, for some, alas, not for all. As glorious as childhood can be, we also have far fewer choices because other people constantly make them for us, as they need to, because we are inexperienced. But as we grow older, and we have more and more experience, we need to make those choices for ourselves because we need to learn from them. Otherwise, our inner authority doesn't take its place in the human family. Yeah? Do you see what I mean? Yeah. So what we leave behind need not be the wonder, need not be the awe, need not be the delight and kindness and patience and joy and laughter and silliness, so-called. But what we can leave behind is the need for other people to make choices for us, the need to rely on an external authority above everything. Actually, in growing up, the time for that is past. We need to make our own choices, our own decisions, and see the consequences of them and take total responsibility for them, which means we can never say, you made me. We can never say, you made me. We can never say, I only did it because. And maybe we can't even say, I didn't know. This is a very long one. I might come to the very long one after dinner.
You sure want to?
Ah, you spoke briefly about loving kindness and attachment. I was wondering if you could please expand on this theme. Well, I could expand on this theme in many ways, but let me just choose one because we only have a little while, a very little while. Sometimes our loving kindness is highly conditional upon getting a reward or on trusting that you are deserving of my loving kindness. Oh, let me give you a quite painful example, rather close to home. At our services at Pitt Street, after our service, we have tea and coffee and what's sometimes called fellowship, although some of the fellows aren't fellows. Many of the fellows aren't fellows. So it's fellow and sistership, comradeship, community. And as we've been having our services for nearly 6 years and sharing retreats, and, you know, people like to see each other. And I also think there's enough generosity of heart that people coming for the first time really do feel included. I'm at the other end of the church, you know, saying goodbye and a few words here and there. But I think those of you who are at the cup of tea end, it's pretty friendly, isn't it? And, you know, that's very, very important in building a sense of community and belonging where everyone can belong, which is the characteristic of our interfaith spirituality, that it is utterly and unconditionally inclusive. And over the last year or two, this has been significantly enhanced by the cake baking of Rebecca. Significantly enhanced. All right. So we set the scene. And I'm thinking of a teaching from Jesus. Come sit at my table. Though you have no money, come. What he really meant was, though you have no rank, though you have no status, though some might call you impure, though some might even call you unclean, come. Pitt Street Uniting Church, where we have our services, is one block from Town Hall, Sydney, in the middle of a city, and we have homeless people living on our steps. Some of our homeless people are very quiet. Some of our homeless people aren't living on those steps, but come on by. And some of them are not quiet at all. Some of them are very disheveled, and some of them are drunk. And when they come in, sometimes for a cup of tea, and maybe for one of Rebecca's cakes, I wonder how hospitable I am. I really wonder. I'm not thinking about how hospitable the people down at the cake and cup of tea end are. I'm really noticing how hospitable I am. So, detaching from our notion of who's deserving of our kindness. Hospitality wasn't one of the words that I put on the list, and I can't think why not, because actually, hospitality is profoundly important in not only Judaism, but also Islam and Christianity. And it's one of the contradictions of the theistic religions that they teach hospitality so explicitly, and yet they suffer the same inhibitions that I find in myself about really extending this notion of hospitality. So the combination of Rebecca's cakes and our homeless brothers, they're all brothers, by the way, and particularly those who are drunk, which really presses a button for me. It's one of my buttons. So be noticing where your buttons are. Not in order to criticize yourself or put yourself down, to expand your comfort zone. Because the table at which we are inviting people to sit really can be larger than we imagine.
Just to make you feel better, the nuns at Cowley, who have an open kind of kitchen and so on, and a gateway where the tramps and people come, they've had to install a bell. that brings help, because they, some of the men who are drunk want to attack the sisters.
Yes.
It's, so, I mean, it just is.
It is, it's difficult. Mm. It's difficult. Mm. And I need also to be compassionate to myself around this difficulty. Mm. You know, it's not just a simple matter of saying anything and everything. Mm. It's again a question of discernment. Mm. But at a more everyday level, we can be quite partial.
When they want to drink the communion wine as well.
Little do they know, it won't do them much good, except to take in.
You never know, it might be blessed.
Well, it might be blessed, that's right. When you have your back to the view, will you remember it still? Oh, what an incredible question. How do we keep our awareness with us? It is impossible to have your back to the view. The view is all around us, and the view is within us. You cannot have your back to the view, which is another way of talking about God. You cannot have your back to the view, but you can forget the view. And what did I write? Over and over again in forgiveness and other acts of love, implicitly and explicitly, and in seeking the sacred, that we may forget the view, but the view does not forget us, and we have only to remember. The one that you are looking for is always looking for you. And how does the one play the game of looking? Through inspiration. Through divine inspiration. Through the word that you need, even though you didn't know you needed that word till you heard it. Through the friend who rings. Through the music that opens your heart. Through the tears that cleanse. Through the bell that reminds you that even in grief there is also a moment of replenishment. What a question. How do we keep our awareness with us? We open to it, and we have our little rituals of remembering. Most of us need our rituals of remembering, don't we? Which is why ritual plays such a part in our self-development and our collective development. Our ritual of remembering that Easter is time for our retreat. Our ritual of remembering that we can keep a Sabbath, sometimes together, sometimes alone. Our ritual of remembering that in every day we need a Sabbath. When are we going to have it? Our ritual of remembering that if we light a candle and put a flower in a vase, it can remind us also and connect us to our own beauty. If we light a candle, it can remind us that there is a light in our hearts that never goes out. If we light a candle, it can remind us of the light in the hearts of those who have left the body, but the light never goes out.
Excuse me, can I just add something?
Please, Hilary, add it loudly so we can all hear.
When Stephanie was talking about buttons before, I feel as you understand this, that what we're doing is finding new buttons.
Yes, that we can find our positive buttons.
Find our positive buttons that remind us of who we are.
Yeah. Yeah. And all the resources that we have within us. When you leave this retreat, when you go back into what we call the everyday world, but we are in the everyday world here too. But when you take yourself back into the other demands on your time, you can remember that you have been reminded of your resources. I haven't given you anything that is not already within you. I've given you reminders. I've given you little windows. I've given you doors. I've given you melodies so that you can sing the song of life with more confidence. That's all. I'd like us just to take a few moments to remember the light that never goes out, that never goes out in us, and that never goes out in those who've left the body. I'd really like us just to be very present to them and allow them to be very present to us for a few moments. Hilary, we might just turn off the recorders because people might want to say the names of some of their loved ones. Faith. Lent was a time of some self-sacrifice so that we could really think we could enter into the realm of suffering to some extent, but we could also strip things bare and really think about what nourished us, oddly. You know, so often we were invited to make sacrifices in terms of what we ate or drank during Lent. No drink, no, but we were children, so we, you know. But we didn't anyway. But the point was there, and you know, so we, for example, as children, didn't eat sweets, or you know, we noticed what was nourishing. I don't know how well we understood it, but at least the possibility was there. So this poem refers to Lent, and it's a storytelling poem. I sometimes wonder what Jesus thinks about Lent. No, very good, because Mark Burrows, who wrote this poem, is not only a Rilke scholar, he's a theologian. I sometimes wonder what Jesus thinks about Lent, that long, slow season when we try to get an honest bead on our mortality. Dust to dust is the bell. Ashes to ashes. And often lose ourselves in reproach and remorse, declaring that we, with all other creatures, are finite and fallible. Well, fallible we are, by the way, dear ones. Finite we are not. Only the body. Only the body. Only the body. Back to Mark. Like them, we crave comfort and give ourselves to the shape of our needs, stumbling along with instincts that sometimes avert crisis and hold tragedy off a little, but never finally. Our intentions sometimes, but not always, noble. Our actions occasionally radiant, but usually flattened by the same dismal measure of worry and envy, jealousy and fear we lament in others. Perhaps Jesus isn't worrying about what we didn't do, or blaming us for what we did so poorly. Maybe he's simply confused by why it is we seem so unable to be awake to wonder and fail to be alive to all that is arising in us of possibility and joy. Perhaps, after all, he's puzzled by our persistent sadness, noticing how ill at ease we seem in this world that flows on and on without our noticing, its beauty overpouring the boundaries of what we notice or can ever fully know. Consider the lilies, he said, Helen. Consider the lilies, meaning all that rises from the dust and endures all winter tucked into that dark bed of soil. Look at the birds of the air, he cried, probably meaning something like the delight which has little to do with a seeing shaped by an exact or certain knowledge. In other words, one could study the birds and never see a bird. Never see a bird. Don't worry about your life, he advised. And finally, I begin to grasp what it might mean to remember him, his large heart and soul, his warm flesh, his kindness to strangers, his sharp tongue, and wonder why we so often seem overcome with sadness and ill at ease in the world he so loved. Perhaps he meant us to think about that wedding, the wedding feast of Cana, and the miracle which began when his mother noticed the hour's need, and how she called him to serve water to wine, the exuberant and ridiculous joy of it all. Or the way he touched those lost at the margins and healed their wounds and lingered to rejoice with them. And yes, surely also how he laughed, as he must have done, when he saw the little man who'd crawled high up in the tree to get a better view. And surely not only then, and also how he wept when he noticed how those busy in the city of their lives found no room for the unprofitable work of grace. How they refused to belong to others in the neighborhood of their need. Perhaps he is still wondering why we reserve Easter for a single day. As if love and resurrection could be so exactly contained when they are happening all the time and everywhere for those who have eyes to see. I wish you eyes to see. I wish every one of you eyes to see. It's a wonderful poem, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Can I tell him that you appreciated it? Mm-hmm. And even I, who've read it a number of times but haven't read it through the course of this retreat and felt so nudged this morning to bring it to you, hadn't really realized how its themes were our themes. He and I discovered each other and made our friendship through the poetry of Rilke, but also I am so touched by Marx's own poetry.